Hello and welcome to the 2023 full year results for Arrow Global. My name is Ben and I will be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded and for the duration of the call, your lines will be on listen only mode. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star 0 and you will be connected to an operator. On the call today, we have Zach Lewis, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer, and Phil Shepherd, Chief Commercial Officer. I will now hand over to your host, Mr. Zach Lewis, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben, and it's a great pleasure to provide the full year results of 2023. Starting off slide 1, as you'll see, we've made really good strategic progress to our goal of being a leading European vertically integrated fund manager. We've made good progress across three different products. So on the credit opportunity side, we raised the 2.75 billion euro ACO2, and as you've seen, with 1.2 billion of deployment, we've made really good progress in deploying capital and using that fund effectively in what is a good market condition. On the real estate side, we had the first close of our discretionary real estate vehicle and are now working towards the second close of that vehicle. On the lending side, we've completed the acquisition of Maslow, and alongside that and the rest of our footprint, which we'll talk about later in the call, that gives us a strong lending franchise with strong origination track record, and we're having very good progress towards closing our first discretionary lending fund. And so by making the progress of having three different strategies, credit opportunities, lending, and real estate equity, off the same servicing footprint, we're really sweating the servicing footprint, driving higher levels of origination and more future fee income. As you see, that's already showing through in the numbers. So origination was 1.2 billion, up 50% year on year across credit and real estate. If you include the Maslow origination numbers, now that they're a wholly owned subsidiary, which was their trailing lending number, and I'll remind you, comes entirely off third-party LP capital, we get to just about 2 billion of originations, which is a very significant growth and represents the direction of travel of our business. As you'd expect, funds under management increased proportionally with that progress, taking us to 9.3 billion of funds under management. We give a more detailed breakdown of that later in the call as to how that's comprised. And we've also delivered an improved profitability from that fund management segment. So even though we've sold CapQuest and Mars in 23, and hence we're comparing a year with the benefit of those two platforms versus a year without it, and also having grown our fundraising team, expanded our lending team, and done several other internal, effectively team builds, including on the real estate side, to support those strategies, despite those increased costs and the lack of two platforms in the year-over-year comparison, the EBITDA is up 12% to 44.7, even after taking into account those comparisons that would make this a more difficult year. But despite each of those, we're still up and up 12%, having absorbed those. Collections were strong at 375.4 million, being 104% of ERC. This is also a big collections year, and so we're focused very heavily on delivering cash. And internally, as we look at that summary, it very much matches the cadence of how we're running the firm, that our focus is very much raising capital, investing capital, and collecting money back. We call it raise it, invest it, collect it. And that is very much the cadence of the business. And you see that. That's what's driving the progression in our fund management segment and our overall results. That's also contributed to leverage reducing to 3.9 times. As we move on to slide 4, what you see is that each of those key metrics, as we've just covered in the overview, have progressed well. I guess the one I would add is that even despite what we've reinvested alongside our funds, we've generated after that reinvestment and having absorbed the higher cost of interest and also absorbed the cost of building out each of these fund managers and products, free cash flow after interest and after all costs, including after all of our co-investments alongside our funds, net free cash flow is $51.2 million. So we'll go into those details more in further slides. And overall net debt came down slightly to $1.297 billion. If we move on to slide five, this is the fundraising footprint we've now built. We have almost 100 LPs all in across all the different products that we run. And so we've really built out this franchise in a way we're super excited about. It's a very scalable investor base. It's some of the very largest and most blue chip LPs in the world. You see it's a nice split between the different regions and the different investor types. And I'm really pleased with the cross-selling that's occurring. We're seeing a continued progress in that these strategic investors are looking at us as their European mid-market coverage solution capable of delivering them lending, credit opportunities, and real estate equity, all in that middle market granular segment where we have a very strong footprint. And so we tend to be the partner of choice, and I'm pleased that we're getting the cross-selling. You'll see that through the course of the years we basically illustrate the progress we've made in each of those products. You'll see how those LPs are leaning in and how we're getting deeper and deeper wallet penetration across that investor base. If I move to page six, again, this has been a really nice environment for ACO2, also for the real estate equity. Obviously, where we're at in terms of real estate markets does create opportunity. And so we've been able to deploy $1.213 billion in those two strategies. We've shown the lending separately, given at this point that's not a discretionary fund in the Maslow format, but it is entirely LP capital. And the lending fund we're describing that we would expect to close in the coming period, that will be a discretionary fund in the same format as our other funds. And so we feel good about that progression. On the bottom right of page six, we show you just where things are. The x-axis of that graph is our composite risk score. That's our experience of beta, effectively. It's the things that drive volatility or risk in the different assets that we acquire. So obviously includes where we are in the capital structure of that asset, includes the quality of the collateral of that asset, includes whether we bought from that seller before, includes whether the asset started on our platform and hence invalidates, effectively removes migration risk from the transaction. And so, as you guys know, we've done about 3,000 deals in total since 05 in this space. So we have a very, very rich data set as to which types of assets perform well and which ones have more volatility. And as you see, we're able to deliver to our investors here in 2023 and rolling into 24, effectively a slightly lower risk program with about 400 basis points of better return. That has been very well received. And again, I think we're very poised to make ACO2 perform extremely well. We've already collected back more than €1 billion euros of ACO1 and already started distributing significant capital back to investors. We've distributed back more than $100 million just in the recent period. And so on that basis, investors are quite pleased both with ACO1 now with over €1 billion collected and with that doing a 16 IRR and with ACO2 that's now doing a 20 IRR off what we think is a very strong portfolio, both in compositional terms and in terms of asset quality. As we move to realizing, so page seven, you'll see that we've continued to strengthen our footprint, so our expertise inside the business continues to be strong. You'll have seen that we've slowed down any kind of follow-on M&A that's been minimal in this period once we acquired Maslow. And so, as you'll see on the subsequent page, our focus is very much sweating the platform we have to drive as much origination and as much collections as you see here from the platform that we have. We have a great platform that fits well across – frankly, 90% of the hard assets that a bank would have. And so we feel like that platform and our investor feedback and the success we're having in raising capital, deploying capital, and collecting capital from that platform is that we're in good shape for the countries we're in to really have the required platform capabilities for both lending, for real estate, and for credit opportunities. If I show off the right-hand side of page 7, what you see is that different view, but similar from the prior slide. Basically, the market's reset nicely. So for many of the overhang of COVID, where there was a high liquidity and low rate environment, that's now reset, and you're now back up to very attractive returns. And I think it's a clear strength of our business model that having the large discretionary funds in situ, and remind you that Arrow only co-invests 10% of ACO2, so we're able to deploy very large amounts of capital, taking advantage of that market opportunity for our investors, whilst, as you see, generating that 51 million pounds of free cash for ourselves after those co-investments from the Arrow portion of the balance sheet. So the model really works where we can scale up, we can invest well, we focus, and you've seen the outcome of collecting well, and on that basis, basically drive that virtuous cycle where investors are getting good results and able to back us across not just the ACO product series, but now also what we call Arrow lending opportunities and Arrow real estate opportunities as well. If we move to page 8, you see a more pictorial version on the right-hand side of what that footprint now is. So, and I think, you know, for those who followed us for a long time, you've seen us take, frankly, you know, 20 years almost to build this out. I mean, we now service $77 billion in assets. We service 35 million separate loans and real estate assets. And so we have a very deep embedded position with strong regulatory permissions where applicable in each of these platforms. This gives us a very different footprint to pretty much any other fund manager. It gives us a very local footprint that allows us to operate in assets we know very well. And if we look at the left-hand side of the graph, what we're showing in that picture is very much how it feels both to our investors and to our team, that we're really in almost a farming mode, i.e. you service $77 billion, you deploy $2 billion a year, you're working off of the footprint that you know where you're servicing the assets and you're using that position of incumbency to work with the 200 banks that are our clients and to generate opportunities from them and then also to manage the local market where it comes to real estate opportunities, you know, borrowers who can't refinance and want to sell the real estate instead or banks who have got an REO and want to sell the real estate instead. And so the thing I'd point out is whether we're lending against that type of collateral, whether we're buying it in real estate equity form, or whether we're buying it in credit opportunities, which for us is an MPL, a bankruptcy, a restructuring, or a secondary tail of an asset that we're servicing on behalf of a fund or a bank, the underlying collateral type that we're managing is extremely similar of that mid-market granular real estate in general is the majority of what we're servicing and acquiring, lending against, and getting as collateral in the ACO context when we buy that. So the collective expertise of these platforms is really second to none. And as our big investors have worked through their diligence and done the site visits and gone through all the different comparisons and servicing reviews and so on, they really see the power of the fact that we have this deep local platform and the fund management and have the capital on a discretionary basis all combined, so that we can act efficiently on small deals where we're the incumbent servicer and buy a highly diversified portfolio. You look at something like ACO1 that's now mature. You know, we've done 350 investments in that fund. There's 9,000 hard assets as collateral. So you wind up with a very nice program that is diversified in terms of the risk decisioning, diversified in terms of the collateral base, and is very hard for other managers to copy who don't have this operational footprint. And so that's really resonating at the moment. And obviously, from a credit opportunities point of view, the higher interest rates are putting pressure on borrowers. That's creating opportunities for us. Net MPL creation is definitely up On real estate opportunities, again, borrowers who can't refinance become forced sellers, and that's giving us some interesting looks. And on a lending side, obviously, the higher interest rates are helping us. A lot of the lending we do is SONIA Plus or Euribor Plus in format, and so our investors are getting really good yields lending against predominantly residential real estate in those strategies and getting the benefit of the higher interest rates. And so all of that comes off a common platform where we have this real center of expertise across all these different platforms that make us a leading player in that European mid-market granular space. Turning to page 9, you see how we've evolved that. The Credit Opportunities franchise, obviously we're already on our second fund. We're about 43% deployed on that fund. And so, you know, sometime late in 24, going into 2025, we'll start talking to you about ACO3. On the lending side, again, we'll have announcements there over the course of this year. We feel really good now that we own 100% of Maslo. We can basically convert that into the same discretionary structure that our other funds work from, all with similar clients. They're overlapping LPs between those strategies. And then on the real estate equity side, we had our first close. That AREO1 vehicle, as we call it, is almost fully invested now. And the fundraising team and I are working hard with Zach Vaughn, who joined us from Brookfield, to develop the AREO2 in a very similar vein, and we've made nice, you know, preparatory progress for that as AREO1 is getting to being fully deployed. And so that's the state of the fund manager. We feel really good about that progress strategically. We've come a very long way in the last 2 years as we've built that out. You see that now starting to come through the numbers, and I would just remind, as I'm sure Phil will, that obviously those funds under management and that origination is the trigger from an internal perspective to all the value capture, right? It's that NAV that we charge management fees on, we charge servicing fees on pretty much every single asset we invest, and then eventually performance fees. And so that combination of activities is such that the bigger this embedded fund under management and the NAV that's deployed gets, the more that you set up the annuity fee streams that come off those captive assets effectively. And so, you know, Phil will go through that in quite a lot of detail over the coming pages, but we feel really good about the progress we've made and the ability off what were incremental platform investments to pull those into coherent products, get the LP crossover that we're getting, and build those out as repeatable discretionary fund series where we get the full economics. We get the management fee and the carry and the servicing fees off the same assets and feed them off the same platforms, which also have had a good year in terms of winning third-party servicing mandates for banks and other clients. You know, all of that is a very virtuous circle in terms of driving capital-light value at Arrow. I'll end my section on page 10, going through a deal that, given it was market-facing, we thought we would mention it today. As you know, and I think this really illustrates the power of the model, i.e. that we have a servicer that put us in a confident place that we could evaluate the assets that were inside AIF and evaluate the market opportunity that set of bonds initially and then the super senior that our funds provided and then the equity we were able to acquire there. You know, we were able to evaluate that and then effectively take that over on behalf of ACO2. So just to avoid any confusion in the market, it was our ACO2 fund that acquired the bonds in AIF as well as the other securities when the restructure completed. And so it was a good testimony of having both the servicer, which gave us the expertise, the future origination flow, and the fund manager who could step in to manage this vehicle, whilst having the capital to deploy. I mean, ultimately, over $100 million was deployed, as the market knows, and without the ACO2 fund, that wouldn't have been possible. I think, you know, we did a good job. Most people are familiar with the transaction. I think it's a good investment for our ACO2 investors, and I think having all of that in one place is quite unique, right? I mean, without that infrastructure to service, originate, and take over the fund management, we wouldn't have been the logical player to lead the restructuring. And without the fund, we wouldn't have had the capital capacity to lead the restructuring. But by having those two things together, it gave us a great opportunity to help our ACO2 investors make what we think will be a great investment in this ACE vehicle. And other bondholders will hopefully perform well alongside us. And obviously, in our space, there are a lot of similar opportunities to this, which we think are attractive for our funds. With that, I'll pass over to Phil to walk you through the financials. Thank you.
Thanks, Zach, and good morning, everyone. I'll start by explaining the cash performance of the group for the full year 2023, which is shown on slide 12. Collections were $375 million, representing 133% of ERC for the full year, and for quarter four were $85 million, representing 104% of ERC. Consistent with reporting in prior quarters, collections include $91.5 million relating to the 50% divestment of the wholly owned UK portfolios realised in quarter two, 2023. Excluding the impact of the divestments, collections were represented 101% of ERC for the year. The strong collections performance has in part driven the 5% increase in adjusted EBITDA to $331.9 million and the year-on-year reduction in leverage from 4.1 times to 3.9 times. Free cash flow generation was $199.7 million for the year, with free cash flow after investment in new portfolios rising 57% to $51.2 million. The strong cash generation, coupled with the growth in capital light income, has led to a reduction in net debt of $27 million. This is despite the investment in the business through bolt-on acquisitions and costs of scaling our operations that I'll speak more about shortly. As we continue to grow our integrated fund manager proposition, management fees and asset management, fund administration and servicing fees continue to grow, and in due course, we will recognise carried interest. This build in capital-light revenues combined with the lower 10% co-investment level, will further improve the cash generation of the business and enable sustainable deleveraging. Moving on to the segmental results and starting with the integrated fund management segment shown on slide 13. The integrated fund management segment represents the capital-light revenues of the group from our integrated asset management and servicing and fund management activities. Reported revenues were up year on year. There is a $27.1 million decrease in the reported revenues since the performance of the divested UK platforms Mars and CapQuest are not included in the reported underlying results. Therefore, on a like-for-like basis, revenues have grown $40.7 million as we expand our integrated fund management franchise with increased management fees as fund NAV grows and the ongoing continued strong appetite for our services from customers with asset management and servicing contract wins. Despite the removal of the performance of our UK platforms from the underlying results and the ongoing investment of circa $10 million in expanding our capabilities to drive future revenue streams, EBITDA has increased by 12% to $44.7 million for the year. As we have reported in previous quarters, the ongoing build of NAV and operational leverage continues to widen the EBITDA margin, increasing from 19.2% for 2022 to 20.2% for 2023. I expect both the EBITDA and EBITDA margin to continue to grow as we scale funds under management, thereby growing management fees, asset management, fund administration and servicing fees, and in time recognising carried interest, with revenue growth continuing the trend of outpacing cost growth. The progress in developing our three investment strategies will ensure that the group can continue to expand origination, which in turn builds
funds under management and delivers capital-light earnings growth. I'll now explain this dynamic in greater detail. Turning to slide 14, where I've set out the IFM profitability by the various component parts, and this should enable investors to gain a better understanding of how the IFM EBITDA will grow going forward. Slide 14 shows the three components to the IFM EBITDA, and I'll discuss each in turn. Firstly, the integrated returns delivered from our core discretionary strategies, with funds under management at the year end of 4.5 billion euros. This is the full capital-light fees, including management fees, asset management and servicing fees, and in time carried interest across our discretionary funds, ACO, our real estate fund, AREO, and in due course, our lending fund, ALO. We have previously guided that the returns generated from such strategies are 40% on capital invested, assuming a 10% co-investment. This is broken down as 30% capital light income, which is reported within the IFM segment, and circa 10% balance sheet investment return reported in the balance sheet segment. The capital light return of 30% is broadly split 10% management fees, 10% asset management and servicing fees, and 10% carried interest or performance fees. And this is consistent with previous guidance given. So based upon a year-end NAV of 2.3 billion euros, with an average NAV during the year of 1.7 billion sterling, the EBITDA is circa 34 million, reflecting the 20% management fees and asset management and servicing fees, since the carried interest is only recognised towards the end of the fund life. The second element relates to the returns from our local and ancillary strategies, equating to 4.8 billion euros of our FUM. This includes third-party asset management, fund administration and servicing activities, and also the internal income generated by our platforms servicing the Arrow back book, which is an intra-segmental charge between IFM and the balance sheet segment. The returns on these activities typically blend to an average EBITDA margin of circa 15%, but like all our capital light income, are still very stable. Based upon revenue of 142 million for the year, the EBITDA is circa 21 million. And I would expect revenue from our local ancillary strategies to grow at mid-single to high-digit percentage per annum over the medium term. Thirdly and lastly, there have been costs of circa 10 million to drive future revenue streams. For example, we've incurred costs to scale our origination capabilities, building bridge lending, where the costs incurred are not yet delivering revenues. And this creates a drag to the segmental EBITDA. Combining these three elements should enable a full understanding of the 2023 EBITDA for the IFM segment. Now turning to slide 15, where I provide further assistance in modelling and understanding the growth of the IFM EBITDA for our core discretionary strategies. As I've explained on prior earnings calls, the returns are driven by origination levels, which in turn drive the growth in fund NAV, which delivers the EBITDA. The first chart shows the origination levels by vintage, which have previously been disclosed. Chart 2 shows the typical ACO and AREO collections profile, and combining these two data sets builds the third chart, detailing the NAV, which I've shown by origination vintage. Origination levels are therefore key to determining the build of IFM EBITDA for our core strategies. And as Zach outlined, origination has grown during 2023 by 45% to 1.2 billion euros for ACO1 and AREO, with a further over 750 million euros originated by Maslow. This growth has been achieved through the investment that we've made in our business. So based upon origination levels of 1.5 to 2 billion euros, which is broadly consistent with current origination, including Maslow volumes, then fee-paying NAV will grow to circa 5 to 7 billion euros, which represents the origination volume multiplied by the current weighted average life of our investments at 3 to 4 years. The 5 to 7 billion euro NAV at a 10% co-investment equates to an Arrow share of 500 to 670 million euros. And at the 30% capital light return I detailed earlier, will deliver IFM EBITDA for our core strategies of circa 150 to 200 million euros, compared with the 34 million sterling in 2023, as I outlined on the prior slide. This helps to understand the inherent profitability of the group based upon maintaining origination volumes at or around their current levels with merely the passage of time, the build of fee-paying NAV, and the recognition of carried interest. Within the appendix, there is further modelling assistance showing the build of NAV over time for 1.5 billion and 2 billion origination levels. Switching back to the segmental results, slide 16 shows the results for the balance sheet segments. This segment reflects the investment returns of the back book investments, along with returns generated on our co-investments in our discretionary funds. Whilst the cash performance has continued to be strong with collections 133% of ERC for the year and 104% for the quarter, the results of the balance sheet segment have been impacted by the divestments of the wholly owned UK portfolios and the broader macro environment impacting overall valuations. As noted previously, no income or costs on the full 100% of the wholly owned UK assets subject to the divestments are included within the underlying results. Under the lockbox mechanism, any under or over performance prior to completion of the transaction on the 50% portion retained by Arrow changed the re-recognition value on completion. During 2022, the EBITDA on these portfolios was circa 16 million, compared with circa 7 million EBITDA on the 50% retained portfolios since the date of completion of the divestment. The impact of the divestment is therefore a year-on-year reduction of 9 million to the reported EBITDA of the balance sheet segment. In addition, the current economic environment has led to softness in portfolio valuations. Whilst our local platforms have continued to collect well, impairment during 2023 was 35.6 million, representing circa 4% of the carrying value of the portfolio investments, compared with a 20 million non-cash write-down last year. The year-on-year impact is therefore 16 million. Whilst the economic backdrop continues to remain weak, the group has delivered strong collections performance, as shown on slide 17. Our continued focus on cash performance has driven collections of 375 million, representing 133% of ERC for the year. These collections include 91.5 million in respect of the divestments of the UK wholly owned portfolios. Without this impact, performance represents 101% of ERC, and collections in the fourth quarter represents 104.1% of ERC at 85.4 million. Collections in the second half of 2023 include only the 50% on the divested portfolios, and these collections are reported net of servicing costs. The 50% retained portfolios are classified within the portfolio investment note as joint venture, and together with the co-investments made through ACO and ARIO are all reported within our ERC net of servicing costs. Within the appendix, you'll see our usual ERC analysis by year, which we have split out between Arrow backbook and co-investment through our funds for the first time, and this will assist in understanding the balance sheet performance going forward. Our collections performance across all types of portfolios and all geographies demonstrates the ability of our local platforms to drive and accelerate collections performance. I continue to believe our ERC reflects assumptions in line with the uncertain outlook and broader economic expectations, and we continue to adopt a cautious approach to the underwriting of new portfolio investments. Moving on to the group segment, which is shown on slide 18, and primarily relates to the centrally controlled overhead costs. The segmental loss has increased from 24.6 million to 32.2 million as we continue to scale our operations. Costs during the second half were 16.8 million, up marginally on the first half at 15.4 million. The additional costs primarily relate to the build of our fundraising capabilities and the upfront costs of the fund setup for ACO2 and AREO. This investment is enabling us to scale our operations. We have driven origination growth of 45%. As I have explained, this is the key leading metric to understand our future growth in fee-paying NAV, driving future capital-light income. And importantly, the group segmental costs are reflective of a business scaled to deliver 1.5 to 2 billion euro origination volumes per annum without the need for further group segmental cost increases. The full underlying income statement is shown on slide 19, which shows the EBITDA segmental results that I have already explained. And for the avoidance of doubt, the loss before tax and adjusting items of 67.1 million does not include any income on 100% of the wholly owned UK portfolio subject to the divestment up to completion, or any profits from the CapQuest or Mars platforms whose results are reported in adjusting items. The result has been negatively impacted by rising interest rates, with financing costs 20.4 million higher than 2022. In addition, as the group grows the euro income, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest in our funds, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility and was a 4 million gain in 2023. The free cash flow generation of 199.7 million during 2023 is shown on slide 20. Free cash flow exceeded the cash investments on portfolios by 51 million, compared with 33 million in the prior year. Investments are now generally at the 10% co-investment level, and as we scale our business across credit, real estate and lending, the increasing levels of capital-light revenue will continue to drive free cash flow and enable the deleveraging of the business. Slide 21 shows the net position, with net debt reducing by 27 million during 2023, with an 8 million reduction during quarter four, funded by the net cash inflow after investments of 51 million for the year. During quarter four, there was a 10 million outflow for the full acquisition of Details, a Portuguese hospitality asset manager, and the net M&A outflow of 20 million for the year includes the bolt-on acquisitions of the remaining 51% of Maslow, Details and Eagle Street, which have in part been funded by the 37.5 million cash inflow from the sale of the UK platforms to Intrum. This was in addition to the 91.5 million received for the divestment of the portfolios. There was a working capital inflow for the quarter of 9 million, with a working capital inflow for the second half of the year being 14 million. The net debt reduction of 27 million is in line with our strategic goals of reducing leverage and repaying net debt. and going forward, the underlying trading is expected to continue to drive lower net debt, particularly now investments have a 10% co-investment level, and the capital-light integrated fund management, EBITDA, is starting to show meaningful contribution to the group's EBITDA. As I have explained, this capitalized income will continue to grow as we expand across credit, real estate, and lending. Slide 22 shows our leverage and funding position. Growing capitalized income, together with a strong collections performance, has driven the reduction in leverage to 3.9 times from 4.1 times at December 2022. And during 2024, the strong collections expected and continued growth in capital-light earnings mean that we expect to make good progress to our medium-term target of 3 times, and further deleveraging remains a core focus. Leverage has decreased from 4.8 times at the end of 2021, shortly after the take-private transaction, to 3.9 times currently, a 0.9 times reduction. We have a strong funding base with no bond maturities until 2026. The weighted average term on our debt is 3.2 years, and we have £227 million of liquidity headroom. Our 120-month ERC was £1.3 billion, 24% lower than December 2022, reflecting the divestment of the wholly owned UK portfolios, and also the increasing level of our ERC reported net of servicing costs, as I detailed earlier. Approximately 59% of our ERC is now reported net of servicing costs. I believe the strength of our liquidity and funding position, together with our capital-light model, leaves us well-placed to continue to progress the expansion of our integrated fund manager model across credit, real estate, and lending. This in turn further drives capital-light revenue growth without placing strain on our balance sheet and facilitates net debt reduction and further deleveraging towards the strategic leverage commitment of 3 times. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thank you, Phil. So hopefully you've been able to pick up through this additional disclosure that we've given on the fund manager segment the way that you see how all of this progress vis-a-vis funds under management and deployment has already and will continue to build a very good quality forward role of fee pipeline. And hopefully with the additional disclosure that Phil's walked through just there, as you analyze that, you'll be able to model that flow through in a much more accurate and detailed way. We're pleased with the progress on that strategic development, the fact that we are now live on the 2 segments, ACO at Big Size, AREO progressively, and that lending will get live this year. And on that basis, we continue to contribute to those fees from different strategies, but using the same servicing platform. As you can tell from our feedback on this call, we feel good about the servicing platform we have and so don't need to do any other substantial acquisitions to have the footprint we need to deliver discretionary funds and that forward fee role across real estate lending and credit opportunities. And so whilst obviously all of us have an impatience to see that flow through and to see the leverage come down, I think you've seen that we've made good strategic progress towards delivering that in a very high potential future way, and we would expect to continue to make very notable progress to the same over the course of 2024. And with that, I'd like to please open up to questions, Ben. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question or make a contribution on today's call, please press star 1 now on your telephone keypad, and to withdraw your question, please press star 2. The first question comes from Bruno Redcutting, calling from PGIM. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi guys. Thanks for the presentation and appreciate the disclosure. It's very helpful in terms of seeing the business and how the transformation plays out. I guess, obviously, just on the kind of looking at the numbers you've provided, and you've obviously said on an annual deployment rate of, call it, $1.5 billion a year, a 10% co-invest, you expect to kind of get towards a $200 million EBITDA from that, from the business. When do you expect to get to that on, I guess, a run rate basis, with those kind of capital light streams coming in? And I guess that's when, you know, I guess in that, when do you start expecting the cash in from performance fees on ACO1 and ACO2, and I guess just kind of drive sort of more consistent capital light streams towards that kind of guided number you provided?
Yeah, sure, I'd say that. I guess I'd refer you to sort of slide 27 in the presentation where we've set out the theoretical example about if you're originating 1.5 billion, and we've also done the 2 billion case, and you see how over a 6 to 7 year period from start that you build up to those levels. Clearly, we're some way into that journey with having origination volumes of 0.8 billion over the previous couple of years, and 1.2 billion in 2023. And clearly that build towards an EBITDA of 150 million in the 1.5 billion case on capital light income streams includes the an annualized version of the carry, which as you quite rightly point out would be back end loaded and slightly lumpy in nature, given it's recognized at the back end of the fund's life. For ACO1, we'd expect that recognition to come in 2025-26, and the guidance of around about 40 million we've previously provided still holds.
Okay, all right, that's helpful. Thank you, Phil. And then just kind of, I guess, on the business performance, just on the deployment side of things, obviously in Q4, if we kind of compare it against the prior year, it kind of was down 25%. So I was just wondering if there's kind of any underlying dynamics there to call out. And then just also on the impairment you've taken in the quarter as well, is there kind of any thing that we should be aware of in terms of what you're seeing in the local markets, which could potentially drive further impairments next year? Maybe, I don't know if it's just collection activity is tougher or anything else that's driving that.
Yep. I'll take that. The on both those sides. So on your first question, no, I think we were pretty happy that origination was balanced as we progressed through 2023 and obviously ended the year 50% up on the prior year. The fourth quarter of 2022 was exceptionally strong. I mean, I think you had coming out of COVID and all the dislocations that have backlogged things coming out of COVID, you just had a serious cleaning of the books from the sellers at the end of 22 that made the end of 22 Q4 number strong, where 23 was balanced throughout. We would say this is a high yielding, good origination environment, and volumes are strong, as you see. So we're happy with that. I mean, you will have some volatility quarter to quarter, but we're pleased with where that is from a pipeline perspective, and having only done the final close of ACO2 in the end of Q1 23, so roughly call it 12 months ago from now, you know, to have deployed 43% of the fund on a gross basis by now, we feel like is good progress. I mean, there's some recycling in there and work through the finer details of the numbers, but I think it gives you a broad sense that we're making good progress. I think on the impairment, it's the flip side of marking the book accurately, right? In that you've seen that we're originating these assets 400 basis points wider on roughly like-for-like risk level. In fact, you know, as you saw in the earlier slide, slightly better risk level than previous. And I think if one is originating at higher yields, the way that our internal process works, and go through all sorts of detail, but the different constituent parts to MPVing future cash flows at higher discount rates, as well as taking a more sanguine view of a couple of the collaterals that are affected by higher interest rates, means that you have to take the good with the bad, right? The good of it is it leads to higher yielding origination. The bad of it is for assets that were bought before the change in interest rates, you've got to take a sober view of what the asset's worth now with the higher interest rates. And so that effectively impairment is just the flow through of that reality.
Okay, fine. So you wouldn't kind of call out any kind of underlying weakness on that front that could be a sort of more of a headwind on a collection activity heading into next year?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's great, guys. Appreciate the disclosure. That's all my questions.
Thank you.
Another reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one now on your telephone keypad. The next question comes from Carl Strecker calling from Guggenheim. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much, guys. And thanks for all the additional disclosure on this presentation. I guess we'll need a little bit of time to work through it, but appreciate it on that front. In terms of the interim situation, how do you look at that? Do you see any opportunities? Do you see any risks in terms of the platform that you have disposed of to interim and the value of the retained portion of those assets? You know, what are your thoughts generally on the situation?
Thanks, Carl. I mean, as you expect us to in such a public forum, we'll be, I think, a little bit high level in terms of talking about such a specific opportunity. We're obviously very aware of what's happening in interim. I think the specifics of that interim business have evolved over the years, and I think they're now addressing some of those specifics, and obviously you've seen that they, even as recently as their call yesterday, have wanted to come down the capital light version, and obviously we started that journey, you could say, by doing private equity co-invest back in 2014. And we've raised our first discretionary fund in 2019, and obviously the bond market has seen that we've had to acquire different platforms over the years to have what we felt is the necessary aperture to have, you know, the lending franchise, the real estate equity franchise, and the credit opportunities franchise to sweat those platforms and to provide a wide enough product set in the European mid-market to LPs, so that we feel that we can generate the $2 billion a year of origination. I think Andreas McCoy yesterday talked about on a euro equivalent doing $700-800 million of origination. We're obviously, you know, 50% above that just in the ACO series. So we feel good about where we sit and our progress on that journey. I think it'd be fair to say all of us want to see that progress continue to go well and are frustrated that, you know, you want to get there faster. You want to see these numbers come through quicker. And I think we're empathetic to that frustration. So it's not a quick journey. It's not an easy journey. But I think we feel like we've got the parts, both in terms of the investment track record, the high quality teams, the platform that we've built up over the years that we've showcased again here today. You know, the fundraising team, Charlotte Gilbert, who joined from Oaktree, and several other key members of her team who came across and now bring additional expertise and relationships to our fundraising program that have paid dividends. So the progress on that journey is something that you know, we're super focused on, and Carl, hopefully you'll forgive me the shameless plug of our own business as opposed to getting into a public debate on the interim thing, but hopefully the comparison of where we feel we are in terms of our strategic progress and drawing the comparison as to what would need to be put in place to mimic that journey, the trajectory of which you guys have obviously watched closely, I think lays down a tough challenge, and obviously doing it from a position of financial distress makes it harder, right? So I think from a public call, that's probably all I could say. I'll say one more thing and then pass over to Phil to talk about the retained component. But the only other thing I'd say is our ambitions are far wider, right? I mean, the Credit Opportunities business we run is a much bigger, broader business that, you know, has not just an NPL business, but also a restructuring business, a bankruptcy business. It operates with real estate collaterals. There's some different things that we do that make it not comparable to the interim situation. And obviously, you know, having Zach Vaughn, who ran Brookfield in Europe, run our real estate business, Tony McDermott, who joined from Morgan Stanley Centerbridge, running our lending business, the Maslow platform, which is a great business. These are, you know, which then gives us a, you know, we've done, as you saw, $750 million of loan origination, which is not something that Interim has a comparable for. And being that lending business in this environment where interest rates are higher and real estate credit is a very interesting asset class yielding, you know, very good private credit returns, and it is being heavily kind of well-received by LPs. I mean, all of those are just non-comparable positions with Interim. So I think the shape of our franchise, what we're trying to achieve across lending, real estate, and credit, the progress we've made over, you could say, 10 years, if you start from when we started doing private equity co-invest, in 5 years, from where we've had discretionary funds, and just the scale of LPs, you know, sitting with $9.3 billion of funds under management versus a, you know, a standing start in the alternative, it's just a completely different picture. So I think, without sounding too bouncy, you know, we're focused on our journey, and you know, there may be opportunities across the sector, not talking specifically to Interim, where others who haven't gotten that journey and who've left themselves from a balance sheet perspective fully exposed to interest rates and with the rising cost of funds, unless they can drive that on the forward book and backfill it on the back book, you know, they've got a balance sheet problem and an income statement problem. And so I feel good about where we are, and I think we turn the ship early enough that we're focused on the right journey in getting through it, but that hasn't been an overnight achievement, as you know, and it's not a job finished yet from deleveraging the way we want to. So I think we're focused on our journey, and obviously you guys can draw the comparisons as you want from a market-facing perspective. But still, do you want to take the...
Maybe just to finish up on that quickly, Zach, do you feel with your investors that within NPLs, Interim would be a competitor, or because they're more focused on unsecured assets, that kind of differentiates the two platforms, or is it viewed kind of commonly by investors in terms of the asset class?
So my view on that is, look, we sold CapQuest and Mars to reduce significantly our exposure to the consumer space. And what I would say there is that, as you will know, the consumer space is the one that has the highest regulatory risk and the highest reputational risk from an LP perspective. And so I think it is harder to build a franchise in an LP context around that consumer space because of the regulatory and reputational risk that comes with, you know, defaulted consumer loans. The second thing I'd say is that there is a I'll give broad numbers here, but I think the point is very important conceptually, which is if you're a bank and let's say you've got 10% of your book in consumer unsecured and, you know, 40% of your book in various real estate categories, and let's say you sell your consumer unsecured for 20 cents on the dollar and you sell your real estate debt for 60 cents on the dollar, you know, 10% of your balance sheet sold at 20 cents in the dollar doesn't require much capital. Buying 40% of the balance sheet at 60 cents in the dollar, you know, requires 12x the amount of capital in my little example. So the, if you're trying to build a business where the primary driver of ultimate economics is funds under management, which then leads to investments, which then leads to NAV, which then leads to fees, doing something that's got 12x the size, i.e. the bigger portion of the bank sold at a part of the cycle, part of the market that requires more capital, I think is a much more relevant position to LPs. And so from what I've seen, you know, having done all the roadshows for now, you know, 7 years, is that LPs have a preference away from consumer and unsecured, where the reputational risks and the reg risks are higher, and to do this at a scale that's relevant to LPs, you probably need to be in the categories that represent more of the seller's balance sheets and at bigger capital amounts. And so, you know, I think that's how we see it. The other two challenges, I'd say, one is that, you know, LPs won't want to back two people that fundamentally make their own money compete against themselves. And so I guess we've had a nice head start of recruiting LPs for whom this space is now covered, and there'll be a reticence, I suspect, to continue to play that position. And I guess the final thing I'd say is our space requires quite big funds. I mean, you see our financial progress, and you go to the prior question, you know, when are you guys going to get there to get to that run rate, right? You need to deploy capital at a big number. You know, we're already 50% above their target amount. I think they talked in the call yesterday about doing 2 billion SEC. I mean, so in the most recent periods, and we're sitting at, you know, the equivalent of 12 billion SEC. I mean, you know, we're 6x where they've been recently. So I mean, I think there's just, I don't want to say no comparison, but we've come a very, very long way over the last 10 years and the last 5 years in particular. And, you know, obviously I wish Intrum well and going down that journey, but I don't think it's going to be a competition with our LPs. It's a different asset class. They're an unsecured consumer. We're in more secured asset classes as a balance, which is why we sold them our unsecured. And then if you look across the scope of our ambition, it's lending, it's real estate equity, and it's credit opportunities. It's a much wider product set and fund franchise. And so we don't see them on the road at all, like literally not once in that sense.
Understood. Thanks.
Phil, do you want to ask the question on the retainer?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you'll appreciate, Carl, that the assets are actually within an SPV structure, so I don't see any risk on the asset side, and clearly the servicer is regulated, and you know those standalone entities, you know, we can replace servicers in the event as is common in any of these type of contracts under certain conditions. So I don't see any risks there.
Understood. And then lastly for me, just around Maslow, how should we think about that going forward? So on page 14, I presume it currently fits into the local / ancillary strategies. Just trying to get a sense for run rate based on their origination volumes in 2023, and then the impact of that new discretionary fund that you're working on at the moment. You know, how should we think about that for 2024 and the impact that full year of Maslow is going to have on revenue and EBITDA.
So in terms of where Maslow currently sits, you're correct. It's in that local ancillary strategies, given they're providing they sourcing third party capital, but it's not on a discretionary basis, and clearly the economics for a discretionary fund are very different from the local ancillary strategies that we have. I guess going forward, you should the origination volumes that will come through into potentially a discretionary lending fund we'll announce later on when we understand those and we've done the first close of that, but in terms of their run rate basis, I guess you'd expect it to continue at or around the current levels sourced by third party capital until we have a discretionary lending fund. Don't know if you'd add anything to that, Zach.
No, I think the key to us is where you ended. So, I mean, it is very important that we get the lending fund done, right? In other words, the full fee capture of management fee carry, servicing fees, and the internal efficiencies of having those on a discretionary basis so we can use the platforms where there's the best market opportunity and avoid the friction cost of deal-by-deal style approvals or programmatic approvals from individual investor co-invests is a much better both economic outcome and in internal efficiency. And so we are laser-focused on, now that we have a nice lending franchise across Maslow and a couple of the other platforms that do lending origination and servicing, effectively coalescing that into a lending product in the same discretionary format so that the Maslow origination in due course moves from that middle ancillary column to that discretionary core column. And I think, Carl, I appreciate it will take you time to digest all the disclosure and redo all the modeling, but I think what you'll see when you do that modeling is that being in the first column is more remunerative and higher margin, and that is very much where we want to take that volume in due course. And so that's the direction of travel, and it's just a management execution point to make sure we get there.
What do you think timing on the discretionary fund for Maslow is? Is that an announcement in 2024?
That's what we're working towards. Let's see over the coming periods, but that is what we're working towards.
Understood. Thanks very much.
We currently have no question coming through, so as a final reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 now on your telephone keypad. Well, there are no further questions, so I will hand you back to your host to conclude today's conference. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Ben. So we appreciate the engagement, and obviously, hopefully, as you work through the disclosure, we address some of the points that people have had on some of the recent calls. Obviously, Phil and I are here and keen to engage. If as you work it through, you've got any follow-up questions, we'd encourage you to please get in touch with us, so we can work on that. And yeah, as you see, there's a big execution year ahead of us in terms of both growing the funds, deploying the funds, collecting the ERC across both our back book and across our funds. And yeah, we look forward to talking with you in May to cover Q1. And thank you for your time today. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining today's call. You may now disconnect. Host, please stay connected on the line. Thank you.